Welcome to Halfstack Data Science, a show about data science in the real world. This is still season 3 and we're continuing our conversations with various data educators. And today we're talking to Valerie Logan. Founding the Data Lodge in 2019, Valerie is as committed to data literacy as it gets. She believes that in today's digital society, data literacy is not just a work skill, it's a life skill. With advisory services, train the trainer boot camps, an extensive resource library and community services at the Data Lodge, Valerie is certifying the world's first data literacy program leads across commercial, nonprofit, and public sectors. Previously, Valerie was a Gartner Research VP as a member of the Office of the CDO research team. She pioneered Gartner's research in the area of data literacy and nurturing the speaking of data by inventing information as a second language, ISL. We talk about this in the podcast. In 2018, she was awarded Gartner's Top Thought Leadership Award for her work in the area of data literacy. In 2022, the Data Lodge was recognized by CDO Magazine as one of the top 25 data startups to watch in 2022. Valerie has more than 28 years of experience, including 2 decades of global consulting and 5 years of applied experience in the telecommunications industry at both field and enterprise levels. She holds a BS in Math from SUNY College at Buffalo and an MS in Applied Math with concentration in operations research from New Mexico State. We talk to Valerie about how literacy in data is like literacy in any language, how to spread data literacy effectively in a business, what are some obstacles to doing this, how you measure the success of a data literacy program, and of course the effect of the emergence of AI on all of the above. Valerie even made a custom Scrabble board just for this episode, and you can see that on our website, halfstackdatascience.com. If you enjoy our podcast, please consider rating and reviewing it on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. But for now, please enjoy our conversation with Valerie Logan. Okay, we're here with Valerie Logan. Valerie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, guys.
Right, we'll start with the question we always start with, which is, what is your job title and what do you really do all day?
My official job title is CEO and founder of The Data Lodge. And what I do all day, I actually love calendar blocking. So I like to think, what do I do all week? It kind of helps me think of it a little differently. So Mondays and Thursdays, I'm running
bootcamps. We can divide by 5 later, whatever you say.
I love it. You know what? Yeah, do the math. Yeah. Is this how this is going to go, Sean? Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Mondays and Thursdays, I tend to run my data literacy program boot camps, which we can talk about later. I have a community of people that have graduated boot camps, so I tend to spend time with them on Tuesdays and Thursdays, hanging out with people who are running data literacy programs. And then otherwise, I'm talking to people who are like, what is data literacy and why does it matter and how do we do this? And then, that's what I do.
And just to piggyback on those people, what is data literacy?
Thank you for asking. So just like any language, literacy around data is an ability to read, write, and communicate, just like any language. But I like to say that literacy is, in this area, a function of mindset, language, and skills. So if you think about whether you're a data scientist or a store clerk or a CEO, everybody interacts with data in different ways. So we talk about data literacy in context, but the mindset, language, and skills is, you know, what is one's attitudes and beliefs towards data? Like, do they think they're a data person or do they say, I'm not a data person? And then language is, you know, the three of us are going to use all kinds of terms in this conversation. Or if you go to an event and there's this word cloud over a data and analytics summit, there's a language there. And how do you be literate in that language? And then finally, some skills, you know, some skills like storytelling and recognizing bias. And, you know, are you a critical thinker? So mindset, language, and skills, just like a language. Yeah. Does that make sense? What do you think of that, Sean?
I like it because it would mean that there are data professionals, data scientists, who are not as literate as they should be, right? I think in my head sometimes data literacy, well, literacy in general, right? When literacy started to get the attention of educators and governments, right? It was about bringing everyone up to a minimum level. But for me personally, like leading a data team and now meeting lots of people leading data teams, it's actually possible to be a very experienced data professional, but with a mindset that is not commensurate with the skills and language. Does that make any sense?
It does, and I'm going to put just another nuance on that that maybe will bring it even further home. So just like any language, there are dialects. And so I created something called ISL, Information as a Second Language. It's my codification of this language we speak, you know, obviously built off of the ESL, English as a Second Language construct. And because I think this needs, it isn't just a cute, cheeky phrase, right? It's something where we really, if we're going to scale data literacy in this shared language, it has to have form and structure to scale it. So when I talk about the language, there's actually dialects, and the dialects are I tend to look at them by industry vertical. So do you speak data in insurance? Do you speak data in manufacturing? And then also the business domain dialects. So like, do you speak audit data, right? Do you speak supply chain inventory data? So your point about, can a data scientist actually be lacking data literacy? It all depends what domain. So they may be a master in data science in manufacturing, but put them in an insurance company. So yeah, there's that. What do you think of that dialects idea?
That's awesome. Yeah, especially because you've got the kind of functional, like what part of the organization's work do you do, audit, finance, marketing, supply chain, whatever. And so that also highlights that, yeah, the way that different groups kind of cohere at any professional gathering, you know, sometimes it's the audit people, regardless of industry, who are going to find it easier to talk to each other than their own colleagues in their own organization who don't speak data in the audit dialect. And I think, David, yes, you know, we met when we were working together. Every single function in where we were working in the automotive industry, and so I do now. Yeah, that makes sense. And so now in my current job, if I meet someone from, a car manufacturer, there is a language that I can quickly get on the same page with them. But there's also a limit to that, because where we worked in the automotive industry was a particular part. And so I can get into one dialect easy, but still have a barrier into the other. And it's that's a really good idea. But I guess I was going slightly deeper of, you have a definition of data literacy. Does that imply data illiteracy? Because you answered my question. Oh, everyone has a dialect, but are there people who think that they're really good at language or skills, but because of mindset, like who are missing one? Is that possible, or are they really correlated?
That is a great question. We love great questions. We're going to talk about that later, right? The art of a good question. So that was a great question, because it is so symbolic of an energy that's out there right now and a reaction that's out there right now. This vehement reaction to the term data literacy by some people, saying, oh my goodness, that is going to insult everybody. We have to say data fluency. And I lean into that, and I appreciate that reaction, and I think it's valid. However, when we have 7 million definitions of data literacy out there, let's first get a clarity on what we even mean by that term before we react to it. So my message is, I actually think maybe we set anchor on shared language first and then talk about levels of that language. And I think there's levels of literacy, fluency, and mastery, for lack of a better progression. And if we can agree that there is a shared language and not have a reaction to that, we're good. Then we can talk about, is literacy the right term for the first shared level of that? But I think it's a really important point, because there's people getting very turned off by data literacy, which is a real shame, because there's a real need. So let me answer the actual question you asked, which is, is anyone data illiterate? I think if you are living in today's age, and you carry a cell phone, smartphone, you wear a Fitbit, you or smartwatch, you play in a fantasy sports league, you shop online, which is pretty much everybody, then I think you have a degree of data literacy. We are all data people to some degree. That's my premise.
This is really interesting because we've just had a conversation about teaching Python with someone else. And the point we talked about there was, you know, people learn Python like from going to Stack Overflow and other sources and sort of get to a point where they can accomplish something, but they don't have a sort of structured basis for their knowledge, right? So they didn't go through a specific training for it. They just ended up with these skills somehow. And so there is still training to be done to bring these people up to the same level. And it feels like a parallel with what you're saying. So, I mean, is that how you think of your target audience, like people with a varying background in data literacy somehow who all need to be brought up to a sort of structured same level?
Yeah, I think there's a yes is the answer. I believe we're generally, we've got kind of a convert, this sounds a little corny, but a convergence of disciplines, in my opinion. So we really, when we're talking about solving problems with data, there's really three disciplines that are coming together to try to have a conversation. There's business disciplines, which are generally people who work in a business role. There's data professionals, like data management, data engineer, data quality, even the person entering data. And then there are analytical professionals, which could be someone creating a dashboard in business intelligence environment, all the way up to the most advanced modelers and analytical professionals. So anyway, if we're looking at this, speaking this shared language as those three sets of constituents, I'd be hard pressed to find anybody that's a master in all of those in all dialects. So yes, I think every person, I think it's more of a profile, like where are you in each of those? Like I have a master's in applied math, OR, original nerdy math girl, right? So I'm pretty strong in that analysis piece, and I'm pretty strong in certain industries. I worked in auto also, so I have some of that business sector, so I understand some of that auto data. But yeah, I think it's a profile across those three dimensions. Not like it's not Boolean. Like are you this or are you not?
Mm. Is there a specific kind of profile that you target or you end up working with more than others?
Yeah, so maybe a little context on that just for everyone that's listening.
Yes, please.
So what we do at the Data Lodge is we typically help chief data officers and sometimes chief learning or people officers to go after this topic of how do we foster the cultural change associated with being more data informed and insight driven. And a main element of that is how do we foster the shared language at scale? And so what happens is that Data Lodge has been around 4 years now, and the organizations that have come forward first, I really consider to be very pioneering in nature because they've been on the front line of this and doing it in this way, not just saying, oh, we need an analytics academy. Let's stand that up. Check, done, right? It's not just training. Training is critical. But it's change management too. So the people that the CDOs and the learning officers identify and they actually allocate either part-time or full-time we're calling them data literacy program leads, and we're certifying them, the world's first data literacy program leads. Just like, think of like ProSci method or Six Sigma method or any of those bodies of work that have professionals. So that has been my mission at the Data Lodge, is to be the home base, get it, lodge, home, you get that? Okay. Home base for data literacy program leads, because it is a new role. Now, the people that are put in those roles and drawn to those roles are almost always internal hires. So it's pretty rare that somebody says, hey, we're going to hire somebody to come fix our culture or work on evolving our culture. So it's almost internal. And I would say it's probably 50-50, either people that are coming from the CDO or data and analytics background, but have a really strong kind of change management facilitation strength, or we see actually, it's fascinating to see people from training and education. I have a kindergarten teacher, in my community who had joined a corporation and started working in data science, but she's got that background. So there's a lot of diversity in this background, and we can talk more about that. A lot of women, a lot of people of color in my community doing this work. That was a long answer, David. Why don't you?
No, it was a great answer. You know, I've got lots of follow-up questions. One thing that I was surprised about is that you said all these people are almost always internal hires. I don't know, that was, maybe I'm in the wrong here, but that was surprising to me. I feel like that's something that companies might outsource because they think it's, I don't know, not less important necessarily, but something to for someone else to take care of.
Yeah, I probably have some bias here because the way that I message this work is I don't think you change culture from the outside. I think you change it from the inside.
Mm.
And so my bias is probably influential there, but I do think that it's about how do you earn trust and respect and even start to talk the language of the business first, and also people who just know and are respected in the organization. And a lot of times people who are looking for kind of a new role, a juicy role, that maybe the CDO is saying, you know what, we're at risk of losing this person if we don't find something really great for them to work on. And they hear about this and they're like, wow, that's great. There have been some external hires, but it's usually when there's just a bandwidth issue, that there's no more capacity in the team. And so they hire out. But I haven't seen it outsourced.
Is there any pattern? You mentioned that the kind of your first customers, the early adopters, are pioneering. Apart from, I'm guessing, relatively visionary people who really believe in it, is there any industry pattern or company size pattern to that? Anything that separates the pioneers from, you know, those who are now coming to you 4 years in?
I love that you're looking for the data. You're asking me about the data and the evidence beneath this. Well done. Well played. I definitely have a strong base of healthcare organizations. So like the ones I name obviously have allowed me to reference them, but Mayo Clinic, Duke University Health System, several of the pharmas. So there's definitely a strong healthcare basis and financial services. So some insurance, some investment firms. Then after that, I've got their picture on my wall, so I'm looking to my right, because my community has 62 members in it now that are data literacy leads or associates of them. What's interesting is we also had quite a bit of manufacturing. And I think that is coming from all of the IoT, a lot of the change with IoT occurring, a lot of the RPA automation going on. But I also think you think about the manufacturing workforce and the need to really support that workforce in more of the digital experience and understanding their impact with data and using insights. So and driving innovation. You know, they are the front line of the innovation. So, manufacturing, healthcare, financial services. As far as the size of the organization, fascinating. I have nonprofits with less than 300 people. I have 160,000 person manufacturing company. And it's actually quite interesting. It's really a function of the CDO and how switched on they are to the and how switched on the executive team is to the importance of intentional work on the people. Surprised? Are you surprised by that, Sean? No.
You know, FSI is just trading data, right? There's nothing really physical being traded between banks or investment firms anymore. Healthcare that might reflect data intensity in U.S. healthcare system, perhaps. Manufacturing has no shortage of data. It's digitized. It's like, how do you interpret these massive streams of data that most of it is not being used for anything? And it turns out you need to be able to read it and write it and communicate with it to do anything useful with it. So, yeah.
One thing that's interesting in manufacturing organizations is, you know, like I was sharing earlier, I tend to approach this as change management, although I don't like to use that phrase because people are like, oh, you're here from corporate for the change management program. Yay. So that doesn't go far. But it is, you know, we're talking about humans changing. So that is change. But one thing that's interesting with manufacturing organizations is Lean Sigma, quality management. And so there are some parallels there, and there's some hangover there too that can be negative, but we at least find that we can use that metaphor of this is kind of similar to what we did with Six Sigma with the workforce, but this is more around the use of data. And that parallel can be helpful for some, not all, but some.
One thing that I'm interested in is, so you deal with all these different industries, how different is your training to those people who then become data literacy advocates in their respective industries, or do you have a very clear cut set of tools and skills and knowledge that you want to impart regardless of what that person ends up doing with it?
It's a really good question for a one woman entrepreneur with two full-time contractors at running a business at scale. So my approach has been to design this universally to be, you know, applicable and leveraged across industries. Now that we're at year four and we're getting to a point where that methodology has been proven and tested out with, you know, field tested with, you know, this type of client, this range of client. We also have five countries, US, UK, Canada, Brazil, Germany. So where our clients are. We're getting to a point now where we're looking at how do we contextualize a lot of the method and the accelerators and the resources by those dialects. So as an example, I have a testing out a little partnership with a company called Green Skies Analytics that do a gentleman named Trent Russell. He's an audit analytics specialist. So very boutique, kind of works with auditors on analytics and kind of his own shop. Well, he came to me and he said, he heard me on an amazing podcast like this one. And he said, my auditors are going through such a change right now because they have been trained on sampling methods. And now there is such an abundance of both quantitative and now qualitative data that they really are yearning and needing some data literacy upskilling. And I just thought that was so fascinating. And I thought, okay, well, audit is one of these dialects. So I'm never going to I'm not an auditor. I don't know that dialect. So I'm starting to build out some intentional partnerships with those that have that specialty. And we're starting to look at, to answer your question, we're starting to look at some of that contextualization. And of course, with our community, we see all their examples of, because they take the templates and the methods and the toolkits, and they each contextualize it for their organization. So already I'm seeing, okay, how are all the hospitals and providers, what's theirs looking like? What are all the manufacturing ones that I can start to see? But yeah, we're at a point of starting to become more contextual and probably hire or contract with people that have that dialect experience. I give long answers, don't I?
No,
I'm sorry.
Great.
Rich answers, very rich answers.
Rich answers, okay.
So when your clients are coming to you and then taking what they learn out to their organization, like what are the top sources of resistance that they're facing? I mean, clearly for them to even be coming to you, there's some amount of buy-in, right? But even for those people kind of leading the way, what are they still finding out there in organizations as the barriers?
Another good question. So there are definitely probably five that come up a lot. I'm going to riff on them really off the top of my head here. But one I would say is time, just having time, you know, the cognitive overload and all of the things going on in organizations. I think just here we go, one more thing. So I think that's an issue is time. I think, you know, certainly the pressure around budgetary pressures and how does this stack up against other programs and initiatives? And we all know what happens with things that look like and feel like and smell like training. they like, oh, well, you know, let's cut that, right? So having that, that leads into the really the clear ROI and metrics around what really, why does this really make a difference? I think that case is a classic challenge. I think the senior leadership, it's not that they're blocking, but they may just not really understand, like, what does this mean? And it's not that they're not data literate. It's that they haven't really been brought, like, even just in this time we've spent together, I'm sure you're having a different view now of, like, what does this woman mean by data literacy? And so it takes kind of a, even just 20 minutes, 30 minutes with some of the leaders to talk through it and let it kind of percolate a bit. So I think there's an issue around how do you engage the leaders when they're so busy, they have such a lot of responsibilities. And then how do you prioritize what you do first when the data literacy landscape is still so emergent in nature and fragmented and everybody has courses, you know, it's very confusing to go out to data literacy land and navigate that and go, all right, what should I do first for the biggest impact? So I think there were like three or four or five in there somewhere.
So many follow-up questions. Again, I mean, one of the things you said is success metrics. What is the way to measure the success of a data literacy program?
Oh, you're asking me.
Yeah, I'm asking you. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, that wasn't rhetorical. I have no idea.
I was like, you tell me. No. So first of all, I'd like to be a little flippant with the ROI question because, you know, it's classically return on investment, of course. But I always like to say, well, there's the other definition of ROI, which is risk of ignoring. Do you really think this is going to develop on its own organically? If it would, it probably would have already. So there's a little bit of that, which is, again, a little flippant. But to me, I like to describe there's kind of a higher level and then a lower level. The higher level is organizations are making a ton of investments in everything related to data management, quality, governance, platforms, AI, right, fill in the blanks. So I view data literacy being a relatively incredibly small investment that is an insurance policy and assurance policy to get the value out of that other stuff.
Mm.
So I think you attach it to that train rather than viewing it separate. That's one thing. The other is how do you really demonstrate that there has been a change in behavior? Part of that is you have to do individual assessments rolled up by team. The problem there is there are, again, wide-ranging definitions of data literacy and as many approaches and attempts at quizzes and assessments and surveys. So again, it's this emergent nature, and that's a challenge because if there was a consistent gold standard on what is an individual data literacy assessment defined with the breadth of what we've been talking about, then I think that's your index, that's your marker, that's your benchmark. But so that's a big gap, and I think that's why we're chasing our tail on this question of metrics and ROI.
So is that something that you think would be a worthwhile thing to exist? A golden standard data literacy benchmark test of some sort?
Yeah, I think, and I'm not shy to say I'm now after year four. I mean, I was 3 years at Gartner doing data literacy research and advisory work. Now I'm 4 years in my own company. I'm 7 years in on this. And I would have thought by now that there would be assessments and consistent bodies of corpus and work. It's not there. So, you know, I am in the process of going after some of that because I just can't wait any longer. My clients are having to do homegrown assessments or they're having to, you know, be satisfied with stuff that's out there. And this is not throwing shade at any people that have assessments and stuff because everyone comes at it through their own lens and angle. But I'm taking a very comprehensive, inclusive approach to data literacy as workforce development. And when you approach it that way, I don't know of any assessments out there that really look at it through that lens. So, so in related to that, if you think about like the Six Sigma parallel, imagine back in the day before Six Sigma became an established body of work that had certification and green belts and black belts, there was, I'm sure there was a frenzy back then. It just wasn't as apparent without the internet. So now it's just a frenzy right now. And I think it's now it's time to have some convergence on standards so this can get some traction and scale. I'd love your thoughts on that, both of you. Like, how have you seen other phenomenon like that? Or do you agree or disagree?
No, the thing that I thought about when you said that was, it was a conversation we had earlier in the series about whether analytics should be benchmarked against some gold standard, right? Whether there should be like a data science certification that you cannot practice being a data scientist unless you've cleared that bar. And so I think related to that is what you just said, that the whole industry is just catching up to this, that, oh, actually, maybe we should do things properly. Yeah. You know, after all these years of just doing whatever we thought and just exploring the frontier or whatever, you know, maybe we should actually do things properly. So I think it's all aspects of analytics is getting to that conclusion.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any shortage of certifications out there, right? There's all kinds of MDM and data quality and, you know, data science. I mean, there's no shortage of that. I think what we're missing is, to solve a problem, you need the business acumen, the data acumen, and the analytical acumen involved. So if we're going to have a benchmark and a certification, we need to be looking at all elements of the problem, not just looking at it as a specific skill independent of the problem.
It's the communication one. It's the language one that's, you know, knowledge and skills, you know, can you do this, can you do that, is relatively easier to test in a way. But with that, all those three dimensions of data literacy, it's kind of obvious why it's so hard. Another reason it's so hard is people come to data land, for want of a better term, once again, from everywhere, right? They learn dialects everywhere. But then also the data that we work with comes from everywhere. Some of it's almost literally just picked up off the shop floor, which I think is one of the barriers to professionalization, right? So Six Sigma, invented by engineers doing engineering in control of their process, right? In control of data creation, in control of how manufacturing works at Motorola or wherever. Most people producing data in organizations, not just the store clerk, but the software developers, don't view, perhaps rightly, that the production of downstream data for other purposes is within their scope. And so I think I totally agree with like why we're going around in circles as a group on little topics, but there's this big existential thing of we're all working with other people's leftovers. And so how do you, as the raw material, is that something that you've seen any of your clients do, is, you know, get this upstream into the data creators, both the manual data creators and the digital data creators?
Yes. They can't do this work well without doing that. So Mayo Clinic, working with the nurses, for example. Who is my other client? One of my other clients, I can't remember who it is, talking about the security officer at the desk scanning badges. Like, they are going to the point of entry of the data and helping people appreciate. And, you know, I always use the, I mean, years ago in college, I was scanning groceries at Tops. Like, I was a Tops girl, right? And I still remember the code for bananas, 4011. Like, I go to the store today and I'm like, I still know 4011. And, you know, you think about just that example of, if that, and I know it's all scanned now with barcodes, but if you think about someone putting in the code for bananas when the avocado comes across, because they don't know the code for avocados, but they know bananas, and then what happens in inventory, and all of a sudden we've got an abundance of avocados, or an abundance of bananas and no makings for the guac, right? So I think even examples like that outside of one's industry to help people appreciate how critical that front end role is, understanding that downstream. So that's the first part of the, you know, the front end. On the creator side, or back on the digital digital data creation, I think that's where it's very complicated. And it's not just understanding the downstream effect of, or the lineage of data. I think it's also understanding the systemic nature of data. And even now, some of the professionals need to understand, how does this relate across an internal or external data marketplace? You know, how is this put into a data catalog? And so, I think it's pretty involved and complex. And that's why a lot of the technologies have come to fruition. So, yeah, to answer your question, there are definitely, in my data literacy program leads, they definitely reach down into the organization and help people appreciate the importance of their role affecting data. And then also governance and literacy often go, like the work on catalogs, dictionaries, glossaries is heavily interdependent with the literacy program. So there's definitely a lot of linkage there. So that's probably where I'll leave that, if that hits the point, Sean.
Yeah, I think we've all seen catalogs that were either created by people who weren't sufficiently data literate, or there was not enough people to read those catalogs.
Good. Yeah. Well, there's this whole, we know this phenomenon around governance and data stewardship, and you know, those poor people in the company that get tapped saying, oh, you get to be a data steward. And they're like, what did I do to deserve that? Right? They just like, oh, why do I have to agree on definitions and facilitate? But if you reframe that as, we need you to help foster the shared language of our company. Maybe that sounds like marketing, but to me, that's a different value prop and importance than, we need you to populate the data dictionary.
Well, I just wish you told us that about 6 years ago, because Sean and I had this exact problem in our industry. It's like people use terms assuming everybody meant the same thing by them, like basic fundamental metrics around across the business. Turns out no one agrees. And so if somebody had said, actually, the way you market this is you tell the person they're fundamental to spreading a shared language, I think we might have sold that a bit better than, please, can you go and create a steering committee to agree on this, and no one ever did it because no one was invested.
Well, and one of the ways I try to thread throughout all the programs at the Data Lodge, and it really relates to this in particular, is, again, we're talking about human change. And one of the ways we'll get attention of people separate from being told to do something as an employee is it interesting to them and is it valuable to them as a person and does it resonate naturally? And so whenever talking about dictionaries and data quality, we always say, okay, you would not tolerate that when you're picking your roster for this week's fantasy league. You wouldn't tolerate that poor data quality there. Why do you tolerate it here? So like constantly finding those ways, the benefit of this is we have so many ways that people use data in their personal lives and rely on it. And it is pretty, pretty consistent now across the population that there's some level. How do we leverage that as incentive and relevance and say, you know what, this is relevant. Why do you tolerate it? Or would you tolerate it in that part of your life? Would you tolerate data quality issues on your fuel or electric gauge on your vehicle? Probably not.
Yeah, that's interesting. So when you put it that way, it sounds like there are lots of angles of attack to convince people and to get the message across. I mean, what's the biggest maybe surprise that people have had thinking what they were going to get out of your data literacy upskilling training versus what they actually did or what you actually do with them?
You'd probably have to ask them.
I mean, did you ever get any feedback like, oh, I didn't think we'd cover this topic or something like that?
Yeah. I would say, what did they get that versus what they expected to get? I think part of what they get is not feeling alone. So they get community and connection, that instead of feeling like, oh, I have this job, I'm trying to put this program in place, it becomes a way, not only do they have community at the lodge, like among other data literacy program leads who are doing this new role, but what happens is they start to build this set of ambassadors and advocates across the organization who become like local coaches, and that starts to become, or they use existing communities of practice, And those people are already coaching people and they're already trying to facilitate language. They just don't have any method or any structure to do it consistently. So I think that's probably surprising is, yeah, we're creating the deliverables and they're, you know, getting the stuff done, but it's the amount of connection and that comes from this.
I imagine it does feel sometimes a bit thankless and isolated. I mean, there is only going to be one or a very small number of data literacy program leads in an organization.
Yeah.
And so to know that there are at least, 62 others is probably quite empowering for those people. Yeah.
And you know, some companies, some organizations, as I work with like Department of Education and other government agencies as well, I've had 6 or 7 that have, from the very beginnings, because I do these boot camps that are cohorts for data literacy leads, and I'll have 4 to 6 companies in there. They put 1 or 2 people in for the program and they go through it together. But 6 or 7 times I've had an organization say, I don't want to be in a cohort. We want to pick anywhere from 6 to, my biggest one was 17 people from our organization only. And we want to seed this change with our network of people. And that takes a lot of like getting the organization aligned on what is this and why are we doing it? But one organization put, a big manufacturing company put 17 people in. Some were from the CDO office, some were from learning and development, some for various functions of the organization, a lot of, kind of rising talent in the organization. I'll tell you what, that is commitment.
Yeah,
to
that's
say
great.
We're going to seed this from the beginning.
It's going to be a pretty terrible segue, but one thing I definitely wanted to ask you before while we still have you is...
You know what a great segue is when you acknowledge it's a bad segue.
Yeah, that was my save. That was the only way I could save that. Because what I'm really interested to hear your thoughts about whether you think this rise in generative AI, ChatGPT and friends and so on, how that's going to impact your work specifically. Because I don't think any of us on this episode are going to argue that the need for data literacy suddenly disappeared. Yeah. But the way we think about it, or the way you promote it, or I don't know, is any of the functional part of it, is any of that going to change? And if so, how do you think?
So the good news is, and I'm actually not patting myself on the back, but I'm kind of happy about the fact that the model that I've been teaching at the Lodge, to me, a good model is one that stands the test of time. And the structure and the model, and there's been refinements over time. My clients have helped greatly to refine it. But overall, the way we've structured it and scoped it has always included AI. And AI is a family and a body of methods under that analysis piece, right? And so again, 3 sets of terms, business acumen, data acumen, analytical acumen. Analytical acumen is a wide, diverse range, including the body of AI methods. So that is where we talk about Gen AI, is in the context of the analytical acumen. So there's that piece. The mindset piece, there's a whole element of how do we calm people down enough to even be critical thinkers about this and appreciate it is new, it is emerging fast. But on the skills side of data literacy, we talk about critical thinking, but we also, that engaging part, we used to only talk about like data storytelling as a way of how do you engage with others around data, and data storytelling was the main way we would do that. Now we've extended that and say engaging is not just human to human. The skill of engaging with data is also human to machine. So
that's awesome.
Grateful that my model has stood the test of time, where now I can just say, okay, here's the human view. Now let's have the plane that is the human to machine view. And yeah, I'm glad that, so now that's how I'm doing it. I'm just refining it to amplify that. But I'm glad for my clients that I didn't have to like redo my whole model.
Yeah, that would be bad for them and bad for their organizations if they were thinking of AI as this weird, separate, special thing that's disconnected from data and business acumen, and it's going to happen to people, or, we're already all trying to calm people down and, get people to think less about killer robot dog cop flying
Exactly.
Stuff. So, yep, it's another set of methods. They can be used for different purposes with different levels of results. You said multiple times in that response, critical thinking, right? And a lot of my education was in social science, which is critical thinking. And in some ways, if generative AI, you know, and its potential to scale disinformation and misinformation, you know, in our personal lives and politics or whatever, but also in corporate world, I might thank it, right? I'm not going to shed any tears for the people who are kind of out of the job of manually doing misinformation, like automating and democratizing the ability to create garbage information, right? I think it can go one of two ways, right? Either it just destroys everything. I prefer to be a little bit optimistic, and it will just refocus everyone on, like, you saw some words on a page, which is just data. What other data do you have from outside that data to interrogate the meaning and veracity of all of that? I remember at school, like, we used to, like, read newspaper articles, and you had to summarize them and try and understand what could be potential biases in reporting of this issue. I'm sure that's not popular anymore because we need to teach people more other stuff or whatever. But, like, just learning to read a short newspaper article and, like, engage with it critically and see where its gaps might be, what would be the follow-up article to this. I'm pretty glad I got that training a long time ago, because it's reading the output from any AI today. It's even more important.
Yeah, I am really glad you made the connection to – I mean, critical thinking is really, to me, being a discerning consumer of whatever's in front of you. And I believe that when we're fostering shared language and literacy of an employee base, every employee is a parent, a consumer, a voter, right? So it is my real mission is to affect societal change through fostering data literacy across massive employee bases. There's benefit to the organization and there's benefit to families and communities. And I'll just share a quick story. So I like to study the literacy movement, and there have been several key pioneers in the literacy movement, but a few women have played a really key role, interestingly, because there's a lot of women in this literacy movement, data literacy movement. But Dolly Parton with giving books away with the Imagination Library with kids. There's a woman named Ruth Colvin who created Literacy Volunteers of America. But then Barbara Bush, former first lady. I guess when you're a first lady, I've never been a first lady, but when you're a first lady, you pick a cause that is going to be your platform while you have that time in office. And the story goes that she was looking at, should I pick homelessness? Should I pick, drug addiction? Should I pick poverty? Should I pick whatever? And she came to the realization that literacy was a root of all of those. So she picked literacy. And to me, I believe with the prevalence of data, I do believe that data literacy and misinformation, I think this is one of the levers in which we can start to really look at and collaborate on our societal problems, and we can at least be discerning consumers of what's being put in front of us.
I think that's a fantastic summary and a fantastic note to end on. Valerie, thank you so much for your time. Just before we go, quickly, where can people find out more about you and the Data Lodge?
Well, don't come to my lodge, because I actually have a lodge. It's not an Airbnb.
Please, no one go to Valerie's lodge.
I was going
to
ask, is it a physical lodge?
It is a physical lodge. It's a house in the a log cabin in the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. We call it Logan's Lodge and the Data Lodge. But while I would love to entertain many people here, people can find me on LinkedIn. Check out thedatalodge.com. And most importantly, just if you want to have this is a conversation to dig into the topic. And this all starts with a conversation. I don't have to sell you something. If somebody wants to reach out and just have a 30 minutes, I'll give you 30 minutes, not a problem. We can have a chat just about what's going on. I have a lot of conversations. And then later, a year and a half later, somebody comes back and says, I think we're ready now. It's fine to just reach out.
Great call to action. Thanks Fantastic. So much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks, guys. Great conversation.